Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about you and your money. You like to relax every now and then. Your money likes to work. And Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. While you're catching up on sleep, your money is up early, automatically reinvesting your dividends. Your money is a total workhorse, so you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
That was the Tarantella opening, a little hey that we begin.
Oh, was it a little?
No, it was fine.
Was it good?
Fine. It was good. It was good. Right. I like the
Tarantella. I can bring it down.
No, we keep going. So we're talking about sports.
And games.
And emotions.
And we just did a thing on rules and creativity.
And now it's time to add yet another element to the mix.
Because what do you get if you put all those three things together?
You
Robert,
get, you get
bring
a,
it. You do get it. A, say it.
You're a little energized here. You get a story.
Exactly.
Really good games are sort of story-generating machines.
For example, here's Allison Gopnik again talking about a little teeny story that happens dozens of times a game in her favorite sport.
One of the great moments in baseball is always that ball is going out there and the guy is going out there with the glove and it might end up in the glove and it might not, and he backs up against the stadium wall and he either he gets it or he doesn't. That wouldn't be nearly as much fun if he was just playing catch, right? That's a fantastic human drama.
So the question we want to explore now is,
what kind of drama do you want?
What kind of drama to you is most fantastic?
Yeah. I think you want the headphones the other way around.
That's our producer, Soren Wheeler.
How's that?
Yeah, something like that.
Who is out of the bathroom and seems to have made a new friend.
So set that up. Who's that guy?
So that's Dan Engberg.
Senior editor at Slate Magazine.
And I brought him into the studio because he told me about this thing that had happened to him.
When I was watching the NCAA tournament.
The basketball.
Men's college basketball tournament.
This was just last year.
And I don't know anything about college basketball. It's a, you know, I have two or three sports that I can pay attention to. Some people have one or two or zero. But college basketball isn't one of them.
But there's this tournament on every year. It's kind of exciting. So he watches.
Yeah.
And what he does, since he doesn't really have any loyalties, he doesn't know who to root for. He just kind of, by default.
I just pick whichever team has the lower seed. Whichever is the worst team.
Why do you do that?
I have no idea. And it came to a head when I showed up at a friend's house and they had the game between Butler and Michigan State on.
It was the semifinals.
And they were both seeded number 5.
So it's like your little system is...
Right. I have no idea which team to root for. So I just was... I started rooting for whichever team was losing. And it was a close game, so...
Butler would make a run.
Then Michigan comes back. And I start feeling sorry for Butler.
Every time one would go up, he'd switch to the other. And at a certain point, he's like, wait a second. This strategy guarantees that at the end of the game, when the buzzer goes, I'll have been rooting for the team that lost.
Right. I've actually created a situation where I'm guaranteed to be disappointed.
You're guaranteed to be disappointed. So Dan decided to figure out, like,
what the hell is going on? Why
would anyone do this to themselves? Is that something that's actually been studied?
Yeah, so there's a small group of psychologists.
That would be me.
And me.
Who are interested in this question.
Underdogs.
Tracked a couple of them down.
My name is Scott Allison.
Nadav Goldschmidt.
2.
University of Richmond.
University of San Diego currently.
So there are these studies that are just sort of hilariously simple, where you take a bunch of undergrads and you put them in a room.
And we give them scenarios to read.
Like a paragraph of...
Yeah. Involving, say, two competing teams. There's a
And it's there's almost no information. The teams don't even have names. They're just... It's Team A and Team B.
Mm-hmm.
Team A is playing Team B in a game. You don't even have to tell them what sport.
Okay.
Team A is considered the better team and is more likely to win.
Who are you going to root for?
80% of the students choose the underdog team.
80?
Yep. In fact, a lot of times it comes out 90%.
9 out of 10, yes.
In the absence of any reason to choose one or the other.
That's almost universal.
And
you can do this study in all different ways, and the answer always comes out the same. You can describe it as two political figures,
you know, running for an election.
Or you can talk about two businesses.
Mom and Pop's electronics store against Walmart.
Or you can talk about two landscape painters who've painted pictures now trending.
Landscape painters?
Yes. We gave participants a painting. Half the participants were told this painting was done by a successful established artist.
You know, so-and-so, who has a gallery show downtown.
And the other half of the participants were told this same painting was done by a starving artist.
First-year art student.
Who's trying to make it in the art world.
Who only has one arm. And
yeah, exactly. And people have this very strong bias in favor of the underdog painter.
So what else do we have? We got landscape painters,
yeah.
Unnamed sports teams.
Businesses,
politics.
And my favorite, shapes.
Shapes.
Yeah.
What would an underdog shape be?
It's just a circle about an inch in diameter moving left to right across the computer screen.
Moving up what could be a hill.
Exactly. As the circle moves up, the circle slows down as it goes up the hill.
Nudging up and then dropping back a little bit, and then nudging up and dropping back a little bit.
Quivering.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then along comes
a second circle that has no trouble getting up that hill.
Cruises past the slowpoke circle.
Zooms right past it.
And sure enough, people have a real preference in some way or another. They're really rooting for circle B.
The struggler.
We get people emotionally reacting to a geometric shape.
When they're sitting there, are they like, come on, come on, you can do it.
Yes.
You're pulling for it. It's going to be like Rudy, you know.
This is how deeply ingrained the underdog phenomenon is in us.
At this point, like, my question is,
why?
Why?
What's going on here?
Exactly.
Why do we do this?
I think that there are two different approaches to that why question.
One of them is this kind of what they call an emotional economics argument, and it goes like this.
If you know that you have an underdog and you have a top dog, so the top dog is expected to win, right?
If you think of this like the way a gambler would think of it, like if you go with the top dog, they're expected to win, so you're not going to get a big payout if they do win.
Minimal emotional payoff.
But you'll lose a lot if they lose.
Meaning you won't feel too good if they win, but you'll feel really bad if they lose.
Yes. But if you go with the underdog,
it's the reverse.
Right.
They're expected to lose. So if they do lose, it's not that big a deal because you kind of figured that was how it was going to go. But if they win, you feel great.
A significant emotional payoff. Yeah.
So it's like betting on a long shot horse. You can put in $5. You're probably going to lose it. But if you win, you might get back like 100.
Exactly. I don't
Just does not feel at all like how I watch sports.
Well, there's another argument, which is these guys say that maybe it's something about fairness.
That deep down, we want to live in a fair society where there's an even playing field.
And there's research that shows that fairness is a pretty deep instinct in us. But I don't know. I mean, like, none of that seems to... I guess the thing is that this whole thing feels like a lot more basic.
Yeah.
If you look back at, like, the stories we tell, this underdog story is ancient.
The Iliad, the Odyssey, great epics from Asia, Africa, that's all the same story.
And so Scott says, you know, maybe we love the underdog because we feel like we are the underdog. I mean, in some sense, just to be a living thing is to fight against the odds.
Think about newborns. You can't be any more weak and helpless and small.
You know, I mean, the baby. I guess that's true. But I don't know. I mean, I don't remember being a baby and feeling like, but I do remember junior high, you know, and I do remember feeling like I would never get a job. And I do remember feeling like there's no way that girl's ever going to like me.
Yeah.
You know,
we need these stories
just to make it through.
They're part of who we are as human beings.
There's actually a very interesting, story about Haruki Murakami, the famous Japanese novelist.
Yeah, author, yeah.
He was awarded the Jerusalem Literature Prize. And this was in the midst or immediately after Israel invaded Gaza. Mm-hmm. And there were more than 1,000 Palestinian dead.
Yeah.
In his delivery speech, he said the following. Between a high, solid wall and an egg that breaks against it, I will always stand on the side of the egg. No matter how right the wall may be and how wrong the egg, I will stand with the egg. Someone else will have to decide what is right and what is wrong. Perhaps time or history will do it. But if there were a novelist who, for whatever reason, wrote works standing with the wall, of what value would such works be?
What value would these works be? It's an interesting word. It's almost like he's saying, like, a story's job is, it's beyond morality, it's beyond truth. Like, its job is somehow to tell you that the world could be a way that we know inherently it never will be. I think that's what he's saying.
Or maybe he's really saying that I stand with the powerless and the powerful can take care of themselves. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a little weight to people who have no muscles of their own.
I'm going to put a little pebble on the scale.
That's the job of a story.
And I guess if the scale is always weighted in the wrong direction, then that's why we love the story, because we need more pebbles.
Well, yeah, but there's a question we haven't asked here.
Which is?
What?
Well, 4 out of 5 of us root for the underdog or the struggling circle, but that's not everyone.
1 out of 5 people are like, screw that circle. I'm excited about the circle.
Yeah, you could probably do some interesting follow-up studies on, like,
who are those psychopaths? Yeah. And so,
well, see, you assume they're psychopaths.
I do.
Actually, oddly, we ended up bumping into a guy who falls into this group.
It's Malcolm.
Yeah, hi.
His name's Malcolm Gladwell. He's a writer
for the New Yorker magazine.
He's also written a bunch of best-selling books.
And in the middle of a conversation, unbidden, by the way, he suddenly says,
"Oh, I never ever cheer for the underdog."
You don't?
No.
Why? Why not?
Because I'm distressed by the injustice of the person who should win not winning.
The injustice of the what?
Losing for the favorite. That is the most exquisitely painful situation to be in. So I remember as a kid, the first time I ever ran, I was a huge track and field fan. 76 Olympics. Dwight Stones lost the high jump, even though he was so far and away the greatest high jumper in the world, because it rained. His technique required absolutely perfect footwork, and he would slip on the tarmac. And I just remember sitting there as a kid, and I was just devastated because I could feel his pain, right? And his pain was so much greater than anybody else's.
What's wrong with you?
It's too painful if they lose. When Dwight Stones loses the high jump, it is literally one of the most painful experiences of my young life. I thought about it for weeks afterwards. I just couldn't wrap my mind around how he must have felt going home. And ever since then, I was like, there's no way you could not cheer for the overdog, because they will suffer. Like, I mean, it's the only humane position, because you were trying to end human suffering.
This is as tortured and twisted a logic as I've ever heard.
I mean, I always thought this was some, you know, rare evidence of my empathy that I felt.
I'm so sorry to have brought you the news.
Exactly.
No, it's also, you know what it is? There's another part of this too, and that is that it is that I have a deep distrust and unhappiness with luck. So I do not like it when the outcome turns on an unrepeatable sequence. So Georgetown losing to Villanova in, is it the 82 NCAA college basketball championships? There is no way, you could play that game 100,000 times and Villanova would still only win that one time. That just, that game, it did more than upset me. It outraged me. I mean, I just thought, this is not, it's just not right. It is like it is a violation of everything. You shouldn't be able to shoot 78% from the floor or whatever I forgot what the number was. The preposterous number and I just, you know, if I had been on Georgetown, I would wake up every night in a cold sweat to this day, just thinking, this is outrageous. Like, what? How did this happen?
That's so weird, because you're a storyteller by trade. Like, what if Hans Christian Andersen had woken up every morning and said, here, I have a great story. There's an ugly duckling, and it just stays ugly. Because, you know, why should it get lucky and be a swan? It's just an ugly duckling.
Robert, we're not talking about stories. I understand stories. To me, a game is not a story. To me, a game is a contest between two parties according to certain rules. And when expectations and rules are violated, some part of me takes offense.
Well, I'm curious, how do you feel about the people who always root for the underdog, which happens to be most people? Do you feel like that's the weaker position morally?
Is it weaker morally? I mean, there's a very unflattering interpretation of this, and that is that on some deep level, I think of myself as a favorite, not an underdog, right? Mm. You know, that's, like I say, that's an unflattering way of interpreting my motives. But, you know, unlike many of my peers, I grew up in a tiny, tiny town and went to a kind of an exceptional high school where everyone left at 16 to go home and milk the cows. So it was like a situation where I did sort of grow up as the, if you had parents who'd gone to college, you were the overdog in my universe growing up. So I, you know, I do sort of, when I was in seventh grade and someone got a better grade than me, it was outrageous to me, right? Because no one should get her, only my friend Bruce should get a better grade than me. You know, he's the only other person in the class whose parents went beyond the ninth grade or who had books at home or who had left the province of Ontario. So maybe there's something in that, that if you grow up in these impoverished environments where you're forced into a particular dominant role, right, you come back to it again and again long after those circumstances have changed.
That's Malcolm Gladwell.
Defender of winners everywhere.
I do hate when winners lose. It is true. It is true.
Now, he may hate it when winners lose, but
we have one that will tempt him to go the other way. I mean, it certainly caught our attention.
Yes.
This is a fantastic story about losers who win.
It is actually one of the best stories of that kind that at least I've ever heard of, except for Chariots of Fire. And it comes to us from our producer, Pat Walters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You took a trip, sort of set it up for us.
Yeah, where did you go?
I went to Stevenson, Alabama, which is this tiny town in northeastern Alabama.
Tiny like as in like one convenience store tiny or?
Maybe two.
Mm-hmm. Maybe two?
Yeah, really small. Anyway, my first stop in this town was this high school.
I'm walking up now to North Jackson High School.
Because I'd heard this story about a basketball game that happened in this school, in the gym here.
How many people can fit in here, you think?
Maybe 1,500, maybe.
That is like a miracle.
Like a what?
It was a one in a million night.
This is David Smith. He's an ag teacher at the school.
Been here since we started the place.
And he says that even now he has kids who don't believe it happened.
These kids come in every year and they'll say, Mr. Smith, did they two really beat five? I said, yes, they did. If you want me to go in there and lay my hand on the Bible, I will. And I'll bring them in here and show them that picture on the wall there that you just seen.
Behind him, there's this little newspaper clipping from 1992 and it shows these three basketball players. The one in the middle is this tiny white kid who actually doesn't really have too much to do with our story. Yeah. But on either side of him are the two guys that did this amazing thing.
Those two guys could have said, well, you know, it's all over with and dropped the ball out of bounds. Or
on the left.
My name is Robert Lewis Collier Jr.
Is this huge guy.
Oh, I was fat. I was fat.
And on the other side is like his exact opposite.
I'm Chad.
Tiny little guy.
I was about 5'6", 7", somewhere in there.
Yeah, and you could dunk if somebody pitched stuff to you?
Yeah, like somebody, you know, pitched. I jump ball for us.
You jump ball?
Yeah.
At 5'6"?
Yeah, 5'6", 5'7", I think, yeah. Because I was real small, but I could jump real good.
Yeah, how did you work on your
jump? So what happened?
Okay, let me set it up here.
Okay.
It's February.
February 14th, I think.
1992. 5 p.m., it's home game, and the gym is completely packed.
It was people everywhere.
About 1,000 people in the stands.
It was people everywhere.
We had a good crowd at that game.
That's Vic Griggs. He's the assistant coach.
Because of the rivalry.
The game that night was against the Fort Payne Wildcats.
And Fort Payne has been a huge rivalry from the very get-go.
They were the enemy.
Football, basketball, baseball, it don't matter.
With Fort Payne, we go at it.
Fort Payne team had more resources, even had more players. And that year, everyone agreed that they were just plain better.
Yeah, I think we would have been considered an underdog that night.
Everyone pretty much thought the Chiefs were going to lose.
Yeah.
Chiefs are our team.
Go Chiefs.
But the game was really close, and in fact, 58-55. In the second half, the Chiefs took the lead.
Go Chiefs!
Then they lost it.
Damn it.
And it's just going back and forth and back and forth.
It was a close game, other than like the rest. It was like, man, they was calling some unbelievable stuff.
And that's the thing that ultimately would make this game so dramatic, is that there was just a crazy number of fouls called.
How many? Like, how many are usually called?
In, like, your typical NBA game, there might be 50 fouls.
Uh-huh.
But in this game, with 3 minutes left...
That is number 71 fouls. Oh, well,
it was like, man.
Yeah, I was going to ask, was it a rough game, or was it that these guys were just, like, calling... Yeah. A ton of fouls.
Yeah, they think they was a little bit of both.
They wouldn't let us play for real, just really actually play ball.
Because according to Robert, how they used to play, it was like anything goes.
When did you, do you remember like the first time that you played basketball? Do you remember how you learned to play?
My cousin, my aunt used to have my great aunt, we call it dust bowl, you know what I'm saying? Back then, it wasn't no gravel. I mean, no concrete. It just dust.
Dust coming up, Eric.
My cousin, the only way had a basketball go.
Right in the, down the street.
Everybody from the projects, they come down and play.
Grown-ups, mostly.
You know, like every Sunday, I used to watch my uncle them go out there and play. Like, they get out of church and play and everything.
The only way for Chad and Robert to get on the court.
You know, we play with the older guys, you know what I mean? Go at it.
Hard.
We will tear them up.
Because, you know, maybe deep down, they maybe believed that the game wasn't just a game.
You know, we'll go out there and play like we somebody else, you know what I mean?
Like, what? Who would you imagine you were?
Oh, back then, Dr. J. As a kid, I said Dr. J. And my dream was...
that maybe he could also be a professional athlete.
And get my daddy out of prison, get mom in a big old house, you know what I'm saying? Take care of my family and everything.
Back in the game... 2 seconds left on the clock.
Come on, Chiefs.
We have the ball, and this scrawny little guy named Travis Smith from the end of the bench is on the free throw line.
So he's going to shoot the foul shots.
Yeah, here's what's important, though. We're down by 2 points. Mm-hmm. Travis has 3 shots.
Oh, he got fouled shooting a three-pointer?
Exactly. Which means...
Travis Smith will go to the free throw spot.
He could win the game right now.
Do it, Travis.
Come on, Chiefs. Chiefs.
First one.
He hits the first.
Makes it.
Woo! Puts up the second one.
It's
good. Makes it.
Yes.
Puts up the third one.
Does he make it?
Botches the third one.
Oh.
Shall we lose?
Tie game.
Oh, it's a tie game.
He ties the game and sends it into overtime.
And who's that?
That's my friend Tom Lake. He's a writer for Sports Illustrated. He told me about the game.
Right here.
This is where things just get totally out of hand.
Right.
The Chiefs take the court. Everybody's in foul trouble.
What does that mean?
In basketball, if you get 5 fouls, you get thrown out of the game.
Oh, and these guys have like close to 5 fouls?
Yeah. And the first thing that happens...
the official just blew another one.
Travis Smith, the guy who put us into overtime...
oh, Travis Smith, he's out of the game.
Fouls out of the game.
When Travis fouls out 59 seconds into overtime...
the Chiefs have only 5 players left, which means no subs.
The game keeps going with a minute 41 left.
They lose another guy.
Another guy fouls out there now. 4.
The Chiefs only have 4 players now.
4 against 5.
4 against 5.
2 seconds later.
The shot is up.
Yet another guy fouls out, so there are 3.
Now there's just 3.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Is that real? Can that happen? There's no rule against that?
Why would you make a rule against something like this? What are the odds it's ever going to happen?
So minute 39.
Minute 39 to go.
There are only 3 Chiefs.
Chiefs are down to 3 against 5.
Chad Cobb.
Robert Collier.
And
Chris Shelby.
So,
with 59 seconds left in the game, Fort Payne's ahead by 3.
Oh, it's 67-64.
Fort Payne gets the ball, tries to drive it down the court. North Jackson steals it, passes it to Chad Cobb. Remember that name. Chad Cobb takes it down the court, pulls up at the 3-point line.
Pulls up from 3, and he hits it, and we're tied at 67.
But then, with 17 seconds on the clock, there's a whistle.
Oh, no.
And Chris Shelby, one of the last 3 remaining Chiefs on the court.
Shelby's out of the game, and now it's 5-2.
North Jackson only has 2 players left on the court.
Two?
2 against 5.
No.
Robert Collier and Chad Cobb against 5.
Game's tied.
67-67. And by this time, you know, you're thinking, well, it's all over. It's all over.
And the next play just baffles me.
With 17 seconds left on the clock, North Jackson ends up with the ball.
There was a timeout called.
This is Jay Sanders, the head coach.
And they came to the side and, you know, what do you tell kids?
Yeah.
You know, you only have 2 on the floor. What the hell are you going
to
say?
They've got time for 1 play, 1 chance to win the game.
And I can remember Chad saying, how am I going to get open?
You know, it just this is over.
Because he knew Robert was throwing it in. And he was the only one to catch it, and they got 4 guys out there.
Yeah, they could quadruple team him.
So now, Chad Cobb will have the pressure on his back.
So me and Chad, we went back out there. We played. And Chad, I look at Chad, I said, man, look, old school.
I know, I just remember Robert was hollering, and we was like, it's backyard. Let's
you know
do
what I'm
this.
Backyard, you know what I mean?
We can beat him.
What, meaning what? Like
Dust Bowl.
He's like, I throw it into you, you go, you just run. Get open.
17 seconds in overtime period. Score is all knotted at 67. They're going to surround Cobb.
But they had one guy on me, two on him, and two of them back.
Chad's got a break free.
I ran like one way and I faked back.
Slammed on the brakes and ran straight back to Robert.
Just hoping he'd get through.
And he was wide open.
I was wide open. And that's when Robert seen me.
Robert threw the bounce pass in.
The ball comes in to Cobb. He runs it down the right sideline.
And just took out down court.
He's just dribbling between people.
Trying to get by guys or whatever.
A little guy?
Yeah. And Fort Payne's, you know, trying to come up double teaming.
Chad's just weaving in and out of these guys.
Just out playing backyard ball almost.
Everybody was panicked.
He may take it all the way in. He will.
I went around these guys and I went in and I seen that I had a layup.
And Chad takes a shot.
He'll put it up.
Takes that last shot.
And he banks it and it hits the back of the, it hits the backboard, hits the other side of the rim. And falls off.
Shot it a little strong.
You're thinking, oh no. And all of a sudden,
it hit the rim, just came off the backboard.
There's Big Robert.
And I was in the right spot, the right time.
And he grabs it. And of course, there's about three Fort Payne people around him.
So I pump fake.
About twice.
When I did, everybody jumped. In my mind, I knew I said, oh, Lord.
And when he puts the ball up against the glass.
Robert Collier on the foul. It's good, Robert Collier made the shot.
The shot went in. It just hit the shot.
The buzzer goes off.
The Chiefs get the ball, and the Chiefs are going to win.
And it was just pandemonium.
Oh yeah, man, everybody come off the bleachers.
I don't even remember walking down to the court. But the next thing I know, I'm being hugged by this woman, a North Jackson fan, and she's slinging me. She is literally just slinging me left and right, left and right.
She's got you and swinging you.
She's got me in a bear hug, and I'm just like a limp dish rag. I'm just flopping around. Of course, then I start hugging her, and we're bouncing around. And then I remember looking out at the circle at half court, and I promise you, there was a pile of bodies 6 feet tall.
It was a huge, huge pile of people.
And on the bottom of the pile,
I couldn't breathe. It was like, oh my God.
There was Chad.
When I was throwing people, I was trying to get up.
But the next day when I woke up, it was like, this just happened. It was just like a dream.
And on Monday morning when the boys went to school,
oh man,
they were mobbed.
But it was just crazy.
How everybody was, you know, talking about it.
Asking us questions, you know what I'm saying? Just asking.
I'll never forget that.
How'd y'all do it? So we got to explain, you know.
They said it over the intercom.
He says a few people even asked them.
You think y'all going to be in the world, Guinness Book of World Record? I don't know, man.
And everywhere they went in town.
People knew, you know what I mean? Everybody knew.
Then a few days later.
David Smith.
Actually, it was Vic Griggs.
Yeah, that's right.
Went and called the news.
Called a reporter in Huntsville, which is the nearest big city.
And I was telling him about it, and he said, well, wait a minute. Did you say you won with two players?
I hung up on him.
The newspaper did.
The news, they hung up on him. Just thought he was crazy.
But 2 days later, they ran the story. And as soon as they did.
But this was in the Huntsville Times, Huntsville, Alabama.
Could you read it to me?
This thing just kind of blew up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, okay. If they ever film it, they might call it the Miracle of North Jackson. That's what many consider the North Jackson High Chiefs' 69-67 victory over the Fort Payne Wildcats last Friday night.
It was everywhere from Portland, Oregon to Maine.
The Associated Press, from the Chicago Tribune.
Plains Dealer.
It would have
Fort Worth
as dramatic an ending as Hoosiers.
USA Today.
Ordinarily, there's no way two players can beat five players in a basketball game.
They have them like kind of eliminated there.
Not unless the two-man team is Charles Barkley and Michael Jordan. But North Jackson did.
There were messages, call this person and that person.
I just remember, like,
it was crazy.
When ESPN came to the school and talked to us.
Sports Illustrated.
They're going to get us a movie deal. And it was just really exciting.
So what happens?
Chad and Robert are riding this high for
months, you know.
Somebody said that Leno or Letterman or somebody even kind of mentioned something on one of their shows at the end of a joke. I didn't see it or hear it.
It seemed to a lot of people that this would turn into something.
I was really hoping from this deal that it might help Chad get a little notoriety and might help him get a scholarship, help him get noticed, help get his name out there, you know. And I don't know. We never know what little piece of the puzzle is going to make that big a difference, do we?
Well, what does that mean?
Well, nothing happened.
Nothing happened?
By the end of the school year, people stopped calling, and the story just kind of faded away.
It was over. I mean, it was just...
And Robert says the game started to feel like it never even happened.
It's been rough for me. I mean, right now, it's been messed up for me.
That spring after the game, Robert graduated high school. He held it together for a while, but eventually fell in with some shady characters.
Drinking, smoking weed, you know what I'm saying?
And kind of lost control of his life.
Really, how?
When I went to see him, he was locked up in the Scottsboro County Jail.
For what?
Lots of different things.
And I know the first week I was in here, I cried every night. You know what I mean? It's like, why am I here? You know, what did I do?
So you said, like, this game happened, and then for a while, you wouldn't think about it because it seemed like it hadn't even really happened, like it was just a dream. Do you think about it ever, besides when somebody comes along and asks you about it again?
Not really, not so much. But see, like, now we got, like, a little basketball goal we made up back there. So that's what we was back there doing when they told me to come up here.
And, you were out back playing?
Nah, we was inside. You know, it's like a little box, you know what I mean? We done made a little net and got little bags like where we put our clothes and, you know, they done cut them out, got like for the nets. And just like, we just got a lot of socks put together like a ball and play basketball.
What about the other guy, the other one of the two ball players?
Chad.
Chad.
Yeah, Chad stayed in town too, and he got married and had a daughter. But about 5 years after the game,
I was just going around on some back roads around a little curve. It's like
he got in this motorcycle accident and tore up his knee.
My knee bent the opposite way. It was pretty bad. Yeah.
Shortly after that, he runs into his old buddy Travis. Remember him?
Travis Smith. Will...
He was the guy who hit the shot that put the game into overtime.
It's good.
That guy.
Yeah. And they got into an argument.
It was basically a situation that shouldn't have happened, but it did.
The details are a little hazy.
Something is him.
But apparently Travis thought Chad was bad-mouthing him to a girl.
Or something. I don't know what exactly. So as I was going home, he was he left the gym. But when I was going home, he was following me. And he came and flicking his lights at me to stop or whatever. But I had my daughter with me. Took her home. Came back out. So, you know, we're a little small town. We fist fight. And I got out of my car and I was like, I only got one leg. I can barely hold myself up. But if you get close enough to me, you know, I said, we can fight. He never said nothing. I said, see, that's what I thought. I said, you ain't nothing. You know, so I turned around. I put my hurt leg in the car because I was driving. And as soon as I was getting my other leg in the car, I just heard shots. I just seen blood shooting up at the steering wheel. And I was like, man.
This is not what the story, this is not what I want the story to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
I thought that this is about, you know, sports in America, it's like a dream factory to some degree. If you have the magic dust, then they try to sell it. So I thought these guys had dust all over them after a night like that, and so someone was going to help them sell it. And
well, like my practical response in my head is like, it's a crappy school for basketball. They probably weren't really that good, like in the whole scope of basketball players that who have the same dreams. Like, I don't know.
I see.
Yeah.
On the other hand,
hi.
Hey.
Is Chatter up?
Even though it was just that one moment, like that still, I feel like should say something about who they are. And when I went to see Chad, I kind of felt like it did.
I'm his son. I'm Patrick.
What do you mean?
Hi.
Hey man, what's up?
Well, the playoffs were on and Chad was hanging out with his kids, Chanel and Chad Jr.
It's Todd.
Dad's pulling for the Heat and I'm going for the Mavericks.
He just don't like how good LeBron is.
I like LeBron, but I'm not just a big LeBron fan.
They were joking around watching LeBron just have this mythically terrible series.
LeBron's not playing too good tonight.
And, you know, Chad's basically raised these two kids on his own. His wife left a few years ago. He gets up very early in the morning, drives an hour and a half to work, works really long hours, drives home. It just seems hard, but he keeps doing it. And this might not sound like the ending you want.
No, I might not be in the NBA or whatever, but I just feel like I'm, you know, I'm happy. I mean, I'm happy with my ending.
Daddy, Dallas is winning.
Got healthy kids. I get to see them every day. If I was to die tomorrow, I'm happy with my ending.
Daddy, where LeBron at?
Just like that 2-on-5 game. You know?
I said it's over. See?
Dr. Nadav Goldschmidt. Radiolab is produced by Jed Abumarad.
Our staff includes
Ellen Horn, Thorne Wheeler,
Pat Walters, Tim Howard,
Rihanna Farrell, and Lynn Levy.
With help from Douglas Q. Smith, Jessica Gross,
Luke Calzinetti,
Rose Eveleth, Kristen Clark,
and Yana Nahonatan. I'm sure that was not even close.
Special thanks to Kim Green, Marjorie Taylor, Elizabeth Stickery,
and the chess team at IS 318 in Brooklyn,
and everyone at PS3 in Manhattan.
All right, I'll see you guys later.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.